Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, New York University Teachers Union Busting 101.
But first, lockout ravages the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation with Lise LaRue, president of the Canadian Media Guild, CWA. Canadians have reacted with, as well they should, anger at CBC management's aggressive move to lock out 5,500 employees, including producers and directors, camera operators, finance employees, schedulers, radio and TV technicians, designers, and a host of reporters. At issue is the broadcaster's desire to create a more flexible workforce by hiring more contract and part-time employees. But their union has said such a move threatens, of course, job security for full-time staff and limits opportunities for future employees. Joining us now is Lise LaRue.
This whole idea of a more flexible workplace, it sounds so nice.
Why
should you be against it?
Flexibility is great, but at a certain point is how much flexibility do you really need?
And at whose cost?
Exactly. Yeah. Right now they have 30% of the folks at CBC are working in a non-permanent flexible way, and 70% are permanent staff. And we say that's probably enough flexibility for any one corporation.
What does this do to the young workers coming into the workplace if management got its way with everybody being flexible?
And that's the last time I'm going to. That's the last time I'm going to use the word flexible,
okay.
Because basically what they want is expendable, not flexible. What does it do? I mean, I really feel this dispute is all about the next generation of media employees, that we're out there on the line now for them. If the CBC got its way and had a workforce primarily or even substantially of non-permanent contract employees, first of all, everybody would be on short leashes. You would not have the ability to create programming without feeling like there'd be repercussion around the corner if you stepped on anyone's toes. There would be no sense of continuity in the place. The CBC is an institution in Canada as a public broadcaster, and I do think the CBC would lose a lot of its traditional. The folks that make it up are the people that know what it does year to year. The institutional memory, that would be lost. People wouldn't, I think they would not choose the career of broadcasting if the CBC as a primary employer in Canada would not give them any sense of commitment. I think a lot of smart, young, potential broadcasters would choose other careers.
Maybe you can also give our listeners who don't probably have as good a sense of what CBC is, how it's structured, and how the news and the broadcasts work. I was going to say north
right.
of the border.
Right. Well, the CBC is a big institution in Canada. It is a public broadcaster in the truest sense, in the sense that it is funded mostly by taxpayers' money, allotted every year by Parliament in Canada. So this dispute really will ultimately, you know, resolved in the public sphere. It's got five networks. It's got major English language television network plus an all-news television network. It's got the same in French. Then it's got two radio channels, coast to coast, a variety of online services and web services, digital radio. It's big, so it is available to all Canadians.
So you're locked out. What is the CBC broadcasting now?
Very little and very badly. Management is putting on a two-hour radio program in the morning that is national. Normally in the morning, radio is regional and local, but they're doing one national show for everybody coast to coast, and they're doing about 7, 8, 10 minutes of news at night. They're doing this using a variety of sources that are not CBC sources. At night, it's the BBC, and the BBC is being used as basically, we call it a strike breaker. It's used about three times a day, the BBC World News. Now, to be clear, the CBC always had a contract with the BBC, but never used it quite as extensively as it's doing now.
Now, you've been out for 2 weeks now.
Right.
And obviously, the programming has certainly been gutted. What is the support from the consumer area for the return of the workers?
Well, at first, people in Canada were puzzled by this. You can imagine, on Monday, August 15th, they woke up to picket lines at their local CBC station in every community, locked doors and, you know, fairly significant personalities on the street carrying locked out signs. It was an odd sight, and in the first 48 hours, people were just shocked that any management, but particularly one of a, you know, primarily professional workforce, not known for, you know, real militant actions, had locked out these 5,500 people. That continues to be the common theme in letters to the editor, in newspapers, radio, all the email that we're getting, not understanding why this is happening. Of course, the other sad reality is many viewers and listeners are going to alternate TV stations and radio stations, and CBC is losing viewers and listeners and will probably never get them back. It's a very significant loss for the CBC.
I always have the vision of Canada as being a lot more sane and rational with regard to especially labor relations policy than the U.S. This is an aberration. What is on the minds of the people that run CBC? What's going on up there? Is this part of a larger trend?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, you know, and our appeal to the public through the politicians is that, does this sound like a management that's in line with Canadian values? We think not. I think what these folks, and it's a small group of senior managers at the CBC, who've been responsible for five strikes or lockouts in the past 7 years with different unions at the CBC. These are hard types. They're aggressive. That is their style. And when in bargaining, they put on the table extreme concessionary language. They wanted to change the whole structure of the CBC, and of course we stood up against it. And I think at a certain point it was like, we're going to roll the dice to see who's tougher. It came right down to that, I believe. I really wish it was a more intelligent, more well-thought approach on the part of CBC management. I wish I could report that. I don't think it is. I think it's a who's tougher and let's see and let's get this over with and let's fight this out approach. Very arrogant, very insular, with little regard for the public to whom we all serve. CBC is a public broadcaster. And those taxpayers are not getting a service, and no one at senior management seems to care.
What's happening within the government? I mean, isn't there tremendous pressure? I know that the chair of the Board of Trustees recently stepped down of CBC. What's happening that they're not being pressured to stop this nonsense?
Well, I think they are now being pressured to stop this nonsense. It's tough, though. CBC is governed by has a board of directors that's supposed to set management direction and all of that. But I think this whole dispute has been aggravated by the fact that we don't have a chair, as you mentioned. She left in April, and they have not replaced her. One of our lobbies in government these past 2 weeks has been, let's get a new chair in there now. The rest of the board is also very new, so I don't think they've known how to take control over the situation. There's no evidence it has. There's no evidence that the board has tried to take control over the situation. So a different board may have reacted differently. This board is very novice and has not, in my view, fulfilled its responsibilities as members of the board. So now the government is feeling the heat. There's no question. All parties in Canada, and don't forget, in Canada right now we have a minority government. It means that the ruling party, the Liberal Party, is in power only through a few seats. And is very sensitive to the two constituents' demands now. And the CBC is a big issue. It is in the papers virtually every day. What they've done is, talked about putting in place a special mediator, which is not bad in and of itself. There's been no action yet on getting the new chair, as try as we might. And I think the sad reality is we've got a hard-line management colliding with a very weak board. It's taken a while for people to go, oh, we have to do something now. And I think we're in that phase. But no one knows precisely what can be done. Do you order this management team out? No one's really got that authority but the board. Board's very ineffective right now. So you see where we're at.
Well, what are you doing to help along this process? I know you've got a strike webpage. I know you're doing podcasts. I know you're sending people out throughout the country. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, it's a very interesting labor dispute in many ways. I've been in the union business for, 15 years, and I've never seen a labor dispute like this. First of all, the union is seen as the absolute victims in this. That's unusual in press coverage of any dispute. Secondly,
maybe you can send some of that press down to the United States,
yes,
and they could take that perspective with some of our strikers here.
I know. And believe me, it's not like our press is any more forgiving of labor than anywhere else. But it's just, it is strange. You have to imagine some of these people on the line are very big celebrities in Canada. These are hosts of major programs that are out there. And so the public is treating them as the victims. You can understand why. So it's interesting in that sense that you've got basically a dispute that's become a cause célèbre, really. It's a cause célèbre for the issue. We're actually towing the line on casualization, essentially, and a lot of labor groups have seized on that and come to the picket lines. In Toronto, there's an open mic, so anybody who wants to speak at a microphone in this middle of the square in Toronto next to the broadcast center can, and they have. So lots of other unions, politicians of all types have dropped by that mic. Celebrities of various types just drop by and speak. And it's that kind of a dispute. It's unusual. There are, caravans of support across the country. And then, in the very unusual move, as you mentioned, it's not just picketing around the block, as is the tradition. We've got 5,500 technicians and broadcasters out there. What they want to do when they're locked out is programming. So many of them have found a way to do that via our website and a variety of linked webcasts or podcasts, or college and university radio. And all of that we're trying to link together through one website called cbcunplugged.ca.
And that website again is?
www.cbcunplugged.ca. And you can access much of that way. Now, people, again, and the other thing about this is we can't harness this. So there's 5,500 folks out there. CBC Unplugged represents what we know of the activity and what we know can link together. But there's way more out there that's sort of happening on the drop of a dime and in every community across the country.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there and wish you well, Lisa LaRue, president of the Canadian Media Guild, CWA. We'll check in with you when you're back at your jobs, as you should be, and stop casualization of the workforce.
Thank you very much.
Union. Well, word up.
Scandalo.
Bomba.
Yo. Yo, the sound came to be a continuity from the ashes of the old. This wisdom is gold, brothers and sisters. It's time to look around. If we don't come massive, we'll be driven to the ground.
It's a new millennium, new piece of history. All the workers come together, it's time for unity. While the rich just get richer, the poor keep a giving.
That's
a sign
right
of the times, reality is what we're living.
The media is deception, we get handed lies. Why you can't cheat a worker, cause a worker is wise. Day after day, we have to keep it going. Year after year, the union keeps growing, taking on to millions that they never work to earn. But without a brain and muscle, not a single will could turn. Not a force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one. Solidarity forever, the union makes us strong. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. Union makes us strong, solidarity forever.
Yes, we kick it on the real, make it so the people feel inspiration, driving all the nation and exploitation. Yes, we gotta pull together, brothers and sisters. Yo, it's time for coordination.
Through our sisters and the brothers, we can make a union strong. For respect and equal value, we have done without too long. We no longer have to tolerate injustices and wrong. Solidarity forever, yes, the union makes us strong.
We're the ones who run the show, just let everybody know. With our brains and our muscle, this is how we get hustled. Solidarity forever, kick it to the people. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever.
Well, we're going to find out more about Union Busting 101. What do you know? Higher education? That's what they're teaching? NYU? Shame on you. That's what they're up to. Union Busting 101. After a hard-won battle for recognition and 4 years with a union contract, New York University is refusing to bargain with the Graduate Student Organizing Committee, which is composed of the teaching, the research, and graduate assistants of the university. NYU is capitalizing on recent National Labor Relations Board rulings, which removes the legal necessity for them to bargain with the union. For more than 4 years, teaching and research assistants through their union have raised and resolved workplace issues with NYU through a contract setting forth wages, hours, and working conditions and the respective obligations of the union representative, employees, and university. We're going to be speaking with Steve Reichner, president of the United Clerical Administration and Technical Union, Local 3882 AFT, and Natasha Lightfoot, graduate student, NYC History Department, and member of the Graduate Student Organizing Committee, Local 2110 of the UAW. And joining us now is Steve. Why don't you give us a sense of precisely what in the world is going on with higher education that they can't see that graduate students are workers and deserve the right to organize and collective bargain?
Universities historically have this sense that they are, because they are, they perceive themselves as a noble institution, that somehow they're above the fray of employment. They're entitled to exploit an underpaid workforce, and they have many different ways of describing job titles and employment categories to justify low-wage jobs with little or no benefits. Graduate teaching assistants is one way to do that. They do it on the faculty level by, you know, creating adjunct faculty positions part-time. I mean, NYU has a plethora of faculty titles, you know, associate assistant professor of whatever, to deny, you know, creating tenure-track positions. And with graduate teaching assistants, this is another area where they feel they're entitled to exploit an underpaid workforce.
Natasha Lightfoot, graduate student, New York City History Department, and member of the Graduate Student Organizing Committee. Come on, you don't do any work anyway. You're just a student. Why in the world should you be given any benefits and treated like a worker?
Because
now, if that didn't fire you up, I don't know what would.
Well, just in short, because we actually do real work. And I would say the majority of the, you know, maintenance of some of the larger classes at NYU, and there are many, especially with the core curriculum that NYU has that's required for most incoming students, bulk of that work is done by graduate assistants. And just explain, I mean, there could be classes with 50 to 150 students, and there are a few teaching assistants that are assigned to those. You have to grade all their papers. You have to attend every lecture. At points, you're asked to give lectures. You proctor exams. You grade exams. That amounts to work, and that work is well outside of the scope of your own work as a student. You know, you spend several hours doing. Many graduate school students can tell you it takes away from their own work on whatever educational pursuits they actually arrived at NYU looking to seek out in the first place. My PhD, I would say, would be done much quicker if I didn't have a teaching requirement, but I have it, and I actually like to teach, but I'd like to be paid fairly for it.
What, you want dental benefits and all that kind of stuff?
That would be nice. That would be great, you know, and health care would be great for myself. And if I just happen to have a spouse or a child, possibly, there are lots of people who choose to do, you know, graduate degrees later on in life.
But NYU is a benevolent institution. I mean, you can just see around the city, they're building all this great housing and wonderful buildings, and they take care of the park there so well. Even without a union, I'm assuming that they're going to continue these benefits. They're going to give you a grievance procedure. They may decide what it is. But, you know, they're going to treat you right, right?
Well, see, that's the thing. They say they're going to give you a grievance procedure. But if you have a grievance procedure where the people who arbitrate aren't detached third parties but actually the provost of the university, you know, if it ends in the higher offices of NYU's administration, if the grievance process ends there, then how fair of a grievance procedure can it be? And there are definitely moments.
Ken was baiting you. You do realize that you really can be a little critical of NYU. Their housing is, of course, luxury. They're one of the biggest landlords. They get the benefits of all kinds of tax benefits. My gosh, what's going on with NYU?
Well, graduate students definitely have housing problems, too. I can speak for many graduate students, but I could also just say for myself. What I'm paid does not afford me to be able to live in or around the village. I actually live
quite far away. And what are you getting paid, Natasha?
At the current rate, we're getting paid $18,000 a year, which, you know, for the academic year, that's 9 months. So we're getting about $2,000 a month, and I don't know if you know about the average rate of rent in New York City.
Oh, I have some indication of that, yes. I live in New York City. But aside from that, what precisely, now we understand what the rate is, and you're talking about $18,000, but what's the tuition at NYU, and what does the administration get paid there, the higher administration?
Oh, well, I'm not sure if Steve might know a little more about what
John
the higher
Sexton
administration
gets paid over $1 million, and he gets free housing.
Ah, that's what I was looking for, the distribution of wealth.
Yeah.
And I will say housing is going to be a major issue in the contract that we are just started negotiating for our members, because it's what's on everybody's mind. You know, we make considerably more than $18,000, and our members cannot afford housing. And so housing is going to be a major issue, not only for graduate teaching assistants, but also for the clerical staff, also for the lower-level managers, and also for NYU students. And that's why NYU is building all this housing, because the students don't have housing options outside of NYU housing.
Steve, you're president of a sister local at NYU.
Yes.
Why do you think it's so important to show solidarity with the graduate students at this point?
We firmly believe that every worker has a right to join a union and has a right to a fair contract that provides living wages, health benefits, and affords you a lifestyle within a reasonable distance of the place that you work. When the employer doesn't provide those things, a number of dominoes fall. For example, the current situation is such that people, our members, have to live farther and farther and farther away from NYU each year just to find affordable housing. Well, when you have a 1.5 to 2 hour commute, if you have children, you have child care issues. You know, those children have to be dropped off and picked up at daycare or school. The schools only open or close at certain hours, so there are issues if you keep to your regular schedule. There are problems when managers want our members to work overtime and people can't get to their children in time to pick them up. You have general punctuality problems.
Well, Steve, what I want to get to, because I think that's a condition of workers in general, and that's why we have to fight for daycare centers and so on. I still don't understand the attitude, the position, the politics of NYU. You think that an institution of higher education is going to be more enlightened, shall we say, and they're fighting aggressively. They're fighting fiercely on this. And with that, I need to know the implications for other workers. I don't get it.
Think about NYU. They're on a $2 billion fundraising campaign, which they are ahead of schedule. They're raising over $1 million a day, and that is from their own press. I'm not making that up. That's what they say, okay, giving all that money. Big corporations. Big corporations want the prestige of giving to the university, having their CEOs on the board of directors, having buildings named after them. These people have a vested interest in destroying unions.
And who are some of these people that have the vested interest?
There's the Tisch brothers have been involved for a long time. The Stern family has a number of buildings named after them.
Julius Silver, who was, I believe, the CEO of Kodak as well. So there are definitely, I would say that NYU has, I would definitely second Steve's comment and say that NYU has a lot of corporate sponsorship and essentially functions like a corporation itself.
Right. And that's where, when John Sexton became president, he outlined what he calls the Enterprise University. And ever since he started implementing his Enterprise University, it really is a euphemism for corporatize the university. It used to be a place, you know, where people, maybe they were underpaid, but they were well taken care of. You know, now it's very, you know, by the book. It's a very similar work experience to working, you know, on at a Wall Street firm or at a bank or something like that.
Let me also ask you, because this is in response to, and we have a minute or two left, I want to understand more about your feelings about the National Labor Relations Board and the decision that essentially after years of organizing really said you can't form a union.
I mean, this is classic union busting. The NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, the Bush Board reversed a prior decision saying that NYU had to recognize the union. Now, under the law, NYU does not have to, but why in God's name won't they do it anyway? They are just trying to use any excuse to bust a union, and that's exactly what they're doing. NYU is teaching union busting 101.
I would say that, you know, much of that is guided by a very conservative, obviously, Bush administration. And I think that it's rather unfair that somehow this ruling can be reversed. I also think it's just unfair because it's a long tradition at public universities to have graduate student unions. So for some reason, for the table to be turned when we're dealing with private universities, it just doesn't make sense. But furthermore, the fact that NYU would back down from what was such a, you know, really groundbreaking and I was hoping trendsetting position on allowing graduate students to unionize 5 years ago, it's disappointing. It's just a sign of how different the administration is now at NYU, that it's so corporate-leaning and so ultra-conservative all of a sudden.
Natasha Lightfoot, graduate student, New York City History Department, and member of the Graduate Student Organizing Committee, Local 2110 of the United Automobile Workers, and Steve Reichner, president, United Clerical, Administrative, and Technical Union of New York University. Tell that darn university they'd better let those folks organize.
Definitely.
For Building Bridges, your community and labor report, I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.